Chapter 34. Under the guidance of Bonifacia, the muleteer, who had been willing to take the responsibility with the risk, he had departed at daybreak of the third day. His remaining forces had melted away during the night. Bonifacia and he rode hard on horses towards the Cordillera. Then they obtained mules, entered the passes, and crossed the Paramoa Vivi just before a freezing blast swept over that stony plateau, burying in a drift of snow the little shelter hut of stones in which they had spent the night. Afterwards, poor Abira had many adventures, got separated from his guide, lost his mount, struggled down to the campo on foot, and if he had not thrown himself on the mercy of a ranchero, would have perished a long way from Sulaco. That man, who, as a matter of fact, recognized him at once, let him have a fresh mule, which the fugitive, heavy and unskillful, had ridden to death. And it was true he had been pursued by a party commanded by no less a person than Pedro Montero, the brother of the general. The cold wind of the Paramo luckily caught the pursuers on the top of the pass. Some few men, and all the animals, perished in the icy blast. The stragglers died, but the main body kept on. They found poor Bonifacia lying half dead at the foot of a snow slope, and bayoneted him promptly in the true Civil War style. They would have had Ribera too, if they had not, for some reason or other, turned off the track of the old Camino Real, only to lose their way in the forests at the foot of the lower slopes. And there they were at last, having stumbled in unexpectedly upon the construction camp. The engineer at the railhead told his chief by wire that he had Pedro Montero absolutely there, in the very office, listening to the clicks. He was going to take possession of Sulaco in the name of the democracy. He was very overbearing. His men slaughtered some of the railway company's cattle without asking leave, and went to work broiling the meat on the embers. Pedrito made many pointed inquiries as to the silver mine and what had become of the product of the last 6 months' working. He had said peremptorily, "Ask your chief up there by wire, he ought to know. Tell him that Don Pedro Montero, chief of the Campo and minister of the interior of the new government, desires to be correctly informed." He had his feet wrapped up in blood-stained rags, a lean, haggard face, ragged beard and hair, and had walked in limping, with a crooked branch of a tree for a staff. His followers were perhaps in a worse plight, but apparently they had not thrown away their arms, and, at any rate, not all their ammunition. Their lean faces filled the door and the windows of the telegraph hut. As it was at the same time the bedroom of the engineer in charge there, Montero had thrown himself on his clean blankets and lay there shivering and dictating requisitions to be transmitted by wire to Sulaco. He demanded a train of cars to be sent down at once to transport his men up. To this I answered from my end, the engineer in chief related to us, that I dared not risk the rolling stock in the interior, as there had been attempts to wreck trains all along the line several times. "I did that for your sake, Gould," said the chief engineer. The answer to this was, in the words of my subordinate, the filthy brute on my bed said, "Suppose I were to have you shot?" To which my subordinate, who, it appears, was himself operating, remarked that it would not bring the cars up. Upon that, the other, yawning, said, "Never mind, there is no lack of horses on the campo," and, turning over, went to sleep on Harris's bed. This is why, my dear girl, I am a fugitive tonight. The last wire from Railhead says that Pedro Montero and his men left at daybreak, after feeding on asado beef all night. They took all the horses. They will find more on the road. They'll be here in less than 30 hours, and thus Sulaco is no place either for me, or the great store of silver belonging to the Gould concession. But that is not the worst. The garrison of Esmeralda has gone over to the victorious party. We have heard this by means of the telegraphist of the cable company, who came to the Casa Gould in the early morning with the news. In fact, it was so early that the day had not yet quite broken over Sulaco. His colleague in Esmeralda had called him up to say that the garrison, after shooting some of their officers, had taken possession of a government steamer laid up in the harbor. It is really a heavy blow for me. I thought I could depend on every man in this province. It was a mistake. It was a monstrous revolution in Esmeralda, just such as was attempted in Sulaco, only that one came off. The telegraphist was signaling to Bernard all the time, and his last transmitted words were, "They are bursting in the door, and taking possession of the cable office. You are cut off. Can do no more." But, as a matter of fact, he managed somehow to escape the vigilance of his captors, who had tried to stop the communication with the outer world. He did manage it. How it was done I don't know, but a few hours afterwards he called up Sulaco again, and what he said was, "The insurgent army has taken possession of the government transport in the bay, and are filling her with troops, with the intention of going round the coast to Sulaco. Therefore look out for yourselves. They will be ready to start in a few hours, and may be upon you before daybreak." This is all he could say. They drove him away from his instrument this time for good, because Bernard has been calling up Esmeralda ever since without getting an answer. After setting these words down in the pocketbook which he was filling up for the benefit of his sister, Deckard lifted his head to listen. But there were no sounds, neither in the room nor in the house, except the drip of the water from the filter into the vast earthenware jar under the wooden stand. And outside the house there was a great silence. Deckard lowered his head again over the pocketbook. "I am not running away, you understand," he wrote on. I am simply going away with that great treasure of silver which must be saved at all costs. Pedro Montero from the Campo and the revolted garrison of Esmeralda from the sea are converging upon it. That it is there lying ready for them is only an accident. The real objective is the San Tome mine itself, as you may well imagine. Otherwise the Occidental province would have been, no doubt, left alone for many weeks, to be gathered at leisure into the arms of the victorious party. Don Carlos Gould will have enough to do to save his mine, with its organization and its people, this imperium in imperio, this wealth-producing thing, to which his sentimentalism attaches a strange idea of justice. He holds to it as some men hold to the idea of love or revenge. Unless I am much mistaken in the man, it must remain inviolate, or perish by an act of his will alone. A passion has crept into his cold and idealistic life. A passion which I can only comprehend intellectually. A passion that is not like the passions we know, we men of another blood. But it is as dangerous as any of ours. His wife has understood it too. That is why she is such a good ally of mine. She seizes upon all my suggestions with a sure instinct that in the end they make for the safety of the Gould concession. And he defers to her, because he trusts her perhaps, but I fancy rather, as if he wished to make up for some subtle wrong, for that sentimental unfaithfulness which surrenders her happiness, her life, to the seduction of an idea. The little woman has discovered that he lives for the mine, rather than for her. But let them be. To each his fate, shaped by passion or sentiment. The principal thing is that as he has backed up my advice, to get the silver out of the town, out of the country, at once, at any cost, at any risk. Don Carlos's mission is to preserve unstained the fair fame of his mine. Mrs. Gould's mission is to save him from the effects of that cold and overmastering passion, which he dreads more than if it were an infatuation for another woman. Nostromo's mission is to save the silver. The plan is to load it into the largest of the company's lighters, and send it across the gulf to a small port out of Costaguana territory just on the other side the Azura, where the first northbound steamer will get orders to pick it up. The waters here are calm. We shall slip away into the darkness of the gulf before the Esmeralda rebels arrive. And by the time the day breaks over the ocean we shall be out of sight, invisible, hidden by Azura, which itself looks from the Sulaco shore like a faint blue cloud on the horizon. The incorruptible Capitus de Cargadores is the man for that work, and I, the man with a passion, but without a mission, I go with him to return to play my part in the farce to the end, and, if successful, to receive my reward, which no one but Antonia can give me. I shall not see her again now before I depart. I left her, as I have said, by Don Jose's bedside. The street was dark, the houses shut up, and I walked out of the town in the night. Not a single street lamp had been lit for 2 days, and the archway of the gate was only a mass of darkness in the vague form of a tower, in which I heard low, dismal groans that seemed to answer the murmurs of a man's voice. I recognized something impassive and careless in its tone, characteristic of that Genese sailor who, like me, has come casually here to be drawn into the events for which his skepticism as well as mine seems to entertain a sort of passive contempt. The only thing he seems to care for, as far as I have been able to discover, is to be well spoken of. An ambition fit for noble souls, but also a profitable one for an exceptionally intelligent scoundrel. Yes. His very words, to be well spoken of. Sigh, senior. Apostrophe he does not seem to make any difference between speaking and thinking. Is it sheer naiveness or the practical point of view, I wonder? Exceptional individualities always interest me, because they are true to the general formula expressing the moral state of humanity. He joined me on the harbor road, after I had passed them under the dark archway without stopping. It was a woman in trouble he had been talking to. Through discretion I kept silent while he walked by my side. After a time he began to talk himself. It was not what I expected. It was only an old woman, an old lace maker, in search of her son, one of the street sweepers employed by the municipality. Friends had come the day before at daybreak to the door of their hovel calling him out. He had gone with them, and as he had not seen him since, so as he had left the food as he had been preparing half-cooked on the extinct embers, and had crawled out as far as the harbor, where as he had heard that some town mozos had been killed on the morning of the riot. One of the cargadors guarding the custom house had brought out a lantern, and had helped her to look at the few dead left lying about there. Now she was creeping back, having failed in her search. So she sat down on the stone seat under the arch, moaning, because she was very tired. The Capitas had questioned her, and after hearing her broken and groaning tale had advised her to go and look amongst the wounded in the patio of the Casa Gould. He had also given her a quarter dollar, he mentioned carelessly. Why did you do that? ... I asked. Do you know her? ... No, senior. I don't suppose I have ever seen her before. How should I? As he has not probably been out in the streets for years. She is one of those old women that you find in this country at the back of huts, crouching over fireplaces, with a stick on the ground by their side, and almost too feeble to drive away the stray dogs from their cooking pots. Caramba! I could tell by her voice that death had forgotten her. But, old or young, they like money, and will speak well of the man who gives it to them. ... He laughed a little. Senior, you should have felt the clutch of her paw as I put the piece in her palm. ... He paused. My last two, he added. I made no comment. He's known for his liberality and his bad luck at the game of Monte, which keeps him as poor as when he first came here. I suppose, Don Martin, he began, in a thoughtful, speculative tone, that the senior administrator of Santome will reward me someday if I save his silver? ... I said, that it could not be otherwise, surely. He walked on, muttering to himself. Sigh, without doubt, and, look you, Senior Martin, what it is to be well spoken of. There is not another man that could have been even thought of for such a thing. I shall get something great for it someday. And let it come soon, apostrophe he mumbled. Time passes in this country as quick as anywhere else. Apostrophe apostrophe, this, Sir Cheery, is my companion in the great escape for the sake of the great cause. He is more naive than shrewd, more masterful than crafty, more generous with his personality than the people who make use of him are with their money. At least, that is what he thinks himself with more pride than sentiment. I am glad I have made friends with him. As a companion he acquires more importance than he ever had as a sort of minor genius in his way as an original Italian sailor whom I allowed to come in the small hours and talk familiarly to the editor of the Porvenir, while the paper was going through the press. And it is curious, to have met a man for whom the value of life seems to consist in personal prestige. I am waiting for him here now. On arriving at the posada kept by Viola we found the children alone down below, and the old Genese shouted to his countrymen to go, and fetch the doctor. Otherwise we would have gone on to the wharf, where it appears Captain Mitchell with some volunteer Europeans, and a few picked cargadors are loading the lighter with the silver, that must be saved from Montero's clutches in order to be used for Montero's defeat. Nostromo galloped furiously back towards the town. He has been long gone already. This delay gives me time to talk to you. By the time this pocketbook reaches your hands much will have happened. But now it is a pause under the hovering wing of death in this silent house buried in the black night, with this dying woman, the two children crouching without a sound, and that old man whom I can hear through the thickness of the wall passing up and down with a light rubbing noise no louder than a mouse. And I, the only other with them, don't really know whether to count myself with the living or with the dead. Queen Sabe? Apostrophe as the people here are prone to say in answer to every question. But no. Feeling for you is certainly not dead, and the whole thing, the house, the dark night, the silent children in this dim room, my very presence here, all this is life, must be life, since it is so much like a dream. With the writing of the last line there came upon deck a moment of sudden and complete oblivion. He swayed over the table, as if struck by a bullet. The next moment he sat up, confused, with the idea that he had heard his pencil roll on the floor. The low door of the cafe, wide open, was filled with the glare of a torch in which was visible half of a horse, switching its tail against the leg of a rider with a long iron spur strapped to the naked heel. The two girls were gone, and Nostromo, standing in the middle of the room, looked at him from under the round brim of the sombrero low down over his brow. I have brought that sour-faced English doctor in Senora Gould's carriage, said Nostromo. I doubt if, with all his wisdom, he can save the Padrona this time. They have sent for the children. A bad sign that. He sat down on the end of a bench. She wants to give them her blessing, I suppose. Dazedly Deckard observed that he must have fallen sound asleep, and Nostromo said, with a vague smile, that he had looked in at the window, and had seen him lying still across the table with his head on his arms. The English Senora had also come in the carriage, and went upstairs at once with the doctor. As he had told him, not to wake up Don Martin yet. But when they sent for the children he had come into the café. The half of the horse with its half of the rider swung round outside the door, the torch of tow and resin in the iron basket which was carried on a stick at the saddle bow flared right into the room for a moment, and Mrs. Gould entered hastily with a very white, tired face. The hood of her dark, blue cloak had fallen back. Both men rose. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.